I? All I have done is buy myself time. The time to write this. I haven't really told anyone anything of use. I've only told a story. But I have told the truth. Isn't that ironic? They sent me because I am so good at telling lies. But I have told the truth. I have even remembered some electrifying famous last words which I have been saving up to finish with. They are Edith Cavell's, the British nurse who smuggled 200 Allied soldiers out of Belgium in the last lot, the 1914 to 1918 war, and who was caught and shot for treason. Her very ugly monument stands not far from Trafalgar Square, and I noticed it, not bombed, but buried in sandbags, when last I was in London. The last time I saw London. Some of her last words are carved on the statue's plinth. Patriotism is not enough. I must have no hatred or bitterness for anyone. She has always got a pigeon on her head, even under the sandbags, and I think the only reason she manages not to feel any hatred for those flying rats is because she has been dead for 25 years and doesn't know they're there. I think her actual words were, "I am glad to die for my country." I can't say I honestly believe such sanctimonious twaddle. Kiss me, Hardy. The truth is, I like Kiss Me, Hardy better. Those are fine last words. Nelson meant that when he said it. Edith Cavell was fooling herself. Nelson was being honest. So am I. I am finished now, so I will just sit here, writing it again and again until I can no longer stay awake, or someone discovers what I am doing and takes the pen away. I have told the truth. 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 I have told. O. HDV. A. 1872. B. Number 4. CDB.
Note to Amadeus von Linden from Nikolaus Ferber, translated from the German. SS Sturmbannfuhrer N.J. Ferber, or May. 30th of November, 1943. SS Hauptsturmführer von Linden, this is my final reminder to you that Flight Officer Beaufort Stewart is a designated NN prisoner. She has been seen twice in your custody, and I will be forced to take formal action against you if it happens again. I recommend you send her at once to Natzweiler Struthof as a specimen, with the order that she be executed by lethal injection after 6 weeks, if she survives the experimentation. If you show this devious little liar one atom's worth of compassion, I will have you shot. Heil Hitler.
Part 2. Kitty Hawk.
I've got Julie's identity papers. I've got Julie's identity papers. I've got Julie's identity papers. Drat, drat, double drat and blast. I've got Julie's identity papers. What will she do without ID? What will she do? Just can't think when it happened. She checked her papers. I checked my papers. Sergeant Silvey checked both of us, that special operations officer who was nannying her checked. Everybody checked. Anyone could have muddled them. drat. Double drat.
She must have mine. This isn't a very good place to write things. We'll ruin my ATA pilot's notebook, and I probably shouldn't make a record in any case. It's the only thing I have to read or write on, or do anything with, until one of the resistance circuit comes back. Can't believe I didn't check sooner. 2 days have passed since we got here. I've looked and looked, and I've got my ATA authorization card, but my license and national registration card are gone. And in their place are Julie's ration coupons and forged carte d'identité. Photograph doesn't really look like her. She's wearing her fur and scary Nazi spy face. Katharina Habicht. Can't think of her as Katharina at all, though she tried to make me call her Kette all summer. I'd only just got used to thinking of her as Eva. Not that my own papers, or lack of, make any difference to me, as I am not supposed to be in France. But Julie, who is supposed to be here, has no identity. I have got her forged identity documents. How? How? Like when intelligence took my clothing coupons, but that was done on purpose, and I swore to be more careful. Oh, I don't know what to do. If I am caught writing this, I will be in trouble whoever catches me. German, French, British, even American. I shouldn't write anything down. Court-martial. But I have absolutely nothing else to do. And I have the most marvellous pen in the world. An Etta pen. It has a tiny ball bearing in the nib and is full of quick-drying printer's ink. The ink rolls over the ball. You can write with this pen at altitude and it does not smudge, and the supply of ink lasts for a year. The RAF have ordered 30,000 of these pens from the exiled Hungarian newspaper man who invented them, and I've got one of the samples. A gift from Sergeant Silve, who is soft on lady pilots and small, fair double agents. I know I shouldn't write, but I've got to do something. Something. That last ferry flight would have been an S-chit, so that means I'll have to make a report. Also an accident report. Ugh. We'll have to do it anyway. I'll work on that. Accident notes. Crash landing in Field Damask, near Olmay, 11th of October, 1943. Aircraft Lysander, R3892. Permission for flight obtained from CO, and I had made 4 successful night landings, 3 on simulated flare path, immediately previous to departure. Flight over channel without incident, although deviated from planned course over Caen to avoid anti-aircraft fire. New route took us from Mont-Saint-Michel to Angers, where the aircraft was shot at from the ground and the tailplane was hit. I took action to control fire, but could not achieve level flight as tailplane control was completely gone, aircraft now trimmed for steep climb and barely manoeuvrable in descent. Now that I think about it, the tailplane adjustment cable must have snapped during the climb out from the dive. I wouldn't have been able to dive. That thought has given me chills, that has. All right, where were we? Stuck in the climb and also lacking some rudder control. Engine pressures, temperatures and fuel levels acceptable, so continue to destination, which, with passengers' assistance, I had no trouble in locating. However, on arrival, found descent very difficult and was concerned about touchdown and agreed passenger should bail out over airfield, as she'd had appropriate training and was more likely to survive a parachute jump than a crash landing with half-full fuel tanks and cargo of 500 pounds of explosive 808 and detonating wire. I'd already attempted 2 circuits over field prior to passenger's departure and found it dead tiring, so I stayed overhead for half an hour to burn off fuel before a final attempt to land. Flare path remained lit, so I assumed and had to trust that I was still expected. Possibly my passenger had come down safely and informed the reception committee about the damage to the aircraft. Maintaining level flight continued to prove challenging, and eventually I attempted a descent. Not sure how I actually managed to get the dratted thing down. Sheer obstinacy, I expect. Rudder wouldn't let me sideslip, and even at low speed, with flaps down and no power, the blasted thing wanted to stick its nose up. Couldn't let go to put the landing light on. came down in the dark tail first and bounced straight back up again. Wish I'd seen it from the ground. Snapped off the whole tailplane, and the poor Lizzie came to rest with the back of the fuselage stuck in soft ground at the very end of the field, near where the rivers meet. The whole aircraft pointing straight up at the sky like a standing stone. Made me think of Dimpler's puss moth crash back on High Down Rise, only the other way up. I didn't know what had happened till afterwards, as the control column thumped me in the stomach and knocked the wind out of me at the same time as the back of my head bashed against the armour plating of the bulkhead. Woke up hanging on my back in the cockpit, staring at the stars and wondering how long before the bang. I'm not managing to make it sound like an accident report. Bother. At least I'm getting it down while I remember. Had switched off ignition and fuel before landing as per pilot's notes, and standing orders for forced landing, so all was quiet. A few creaks and groans, but nothing else. Then, three men of the reception committee, one of them English, an SOE agent, the organiser of this circuit, codenamed Paul, slid open the canopy and pulled me out of the cockpit upside down. All four of us landed on the ground in a big heap. These were my first words on French soil. Sorry, I'm sorry, I'm so sorry. Over and over, thinking of the unlucky pair of refugees who were supposed to be ferried back to England on my return trip. And for good measure, I remembered to say in French, Je suis désolé. Oh, what a mess. They helped me sit up and tried to get the mud off me. This'll be our Verity, the SOE organiser Paul said in English. I'm not Verity. This was not helpful information, but it is what I burst out with. Confusion and mayhem and a gun held to my head. Sorry to say, the gun was far too much to cope with following my first ever reportable prank, in a plane I probably shouldn't have been flying, and I burst into tears. Not Verity? Who the hell are you? Kitty Hawk, I sobbed. Codename Kitty Hawk. First officer, Air Transport Auxiliary. Kitty Hawk? My God! Exclaimed the English agent. You flew me to RAF Special Duties the night I came to France, Paul explained me in French to his companions, then turned back to me and said, We were expecting Peter. He had a smash-up in his motor car this afternoon. I shouldn't... He covered my mouth with a big muddy hand and commanded, Don't say anything that could compromise you. I started blubbing again. What happened? He asked. Flak over Angers, I sobbed. This was my proper normal guns and bombs reaction, coming an hour and a half later than usual. Set fire to the tail and disconnected the tailplane trim cable, and I think one of the rudder cables too. Had to dive to put the fire out, knocked poor Verity out cold in the back, and then had to fight the plane so hard for the last leg that I couldn't look at the map. And more sob, sob. Sob. Dead embarrassing. You were hit! They were all astonished. Not because I'd been hit, I discovered later, but because I'd successfully managed not to go down in flames over Angers and had safely delivered them their £500 of explosive 808. They have been painfully nice to me ever since, all of them. I don't really deserve it. There is only one reason I did not go down in flames over Angers. That is because I knew I had Julie in the back. Would never have had the presence of mind to put that fire out if I hadn't been trying to save her life. Going to have to destroy your plane, I'm afraid, Paul said next. Didn't know what he meant at first, as I thought I'd done a dead brilliant job of destroying it myself. Won't be able to use this field again, he said. Pity. However, they'd shot a German sentry. I really ought not to be writing this. I don't care. I'll burn it later. Can't think straight unless I write it. They'd shot a German sentry. He had come along on his bicycle at the wrong moment while they were laying out the flare path. He stood for a while watching, and as it turned out, taking notes, when they spotted him. He pedalled off as fast as he could go, and they couldn't chase him on foot or get to their own bicycles in time to catch up with him. So the English agent shot him, just like that. They were pleased to have bagged a bicycle, but horrified that they had a body to dispose of. The wrecked Lizzie, with living pilot, was a godsend. They would have had to destroy the plane anyway, to make it look like a crash rather than a planned landing. So they installed the dead patrolman in the pilot's cockpit, dressed in my ATA tunic and slacks, believe it or not. They had to slit the trousers right down the side seams to get them on the poor chap, and even then couldn't fasten them. He was so much wider than me. It all took a while, and I didn't help much, sitting quite dazed on the edge of the field, wearing only vest and knickers under a borrowed jumper and overcoat. Mitraillette, who gave me her pullover, must have been freezing with only that frilly blouse under her coat. They also took my boots. I'm broken-hearted about my boots. But apart from my flight bag, all my British pilot's gear had to be destroyed, helmet and parachute and all. Even my gas mask. Won't miss that. All it ever did was take up space, dangling uselessly over my shoulder in its haversack like a wingless khaki albatross for the past 4 years. Don't think I ever put it on except for drills. Wish I'd taken that typist's course now. Could do with knowing shorthand. I've managed to fit this in 3 pages of my pilot's notes in the titchiest print ever. It's not a bad thing if it's impossible to read. Getting the plane ready to blow to blazes took a long time, and a lot of running around in the moonlight. Suppose they're organised, but I hadn't much clue what was going on and was neither useful nor necessary at this point. I was also developing a splitting headache, anxious about Julie, and wondering why they didn't just set the dratty plane on fire and get it over with. Turns out they had quite a lot of equipment they wanted to get rid of, in addition to the damning corpse. 6 useless wireless sets they'd stripped for parts, plus a couple of obsolete ones nobody wanted anymore. They sent someone to fetch them out of hiding, headed off on bicycles, and returned with wheelbarrows. The barn they'd used to hide this stuff is where I'm hiding now. The farmer who owns it threw in an old gramophone missing its horn and a broken typewriter in a cardboard suitcase, and a chick incubator full of bits of wire too short to connect to anything, to make it look like the plane had been carrying a full load of wireless sets. Mitraillette, the farmer's elder daughter, who was the only other girl there besides me, was very jolly about filling the plane with rubbish. Onze radio! She kept muttering to herself and giggling. Onze radio! 11 wireless sets. It is a joke because it is so unlikely we would send 11 sets at once. Each set is linked to its operator, and each operator is equipped with distinct code and crystals and frequencies. It will puzzle the Germans when they examine the wreckage. The 500 pounds of explosive 808 was dragged away on a horse-drawn wagon. It took time to find it all, as a few of the boxes had fallen out of the damaged fuselage and the rear cockpit, which Julie had left open, of course. She'd done a jolly good job of tying most of the cargo down. It was all done by moonlight because nobody dared use any lights. There was an early curfew, so everybody was growing extremely nervous. I'd landed after 1 a.m. and it took about an hour to organise the destruction of the Lizzie. Can't say I feel entirely safe in the hands of the resistance, but they are certainly resourceful. Once the radios and mock radios were piled up and the dead German fixed in place, they simply opened the fuel tanks. Of course, the plane was nearly vertical and the fuel came pouring out. And used the bit of the explosive and detonating wire to light it. Easy peasy. It made a very jolly bonfire. It must have been nearly 3 a.m. by the time we raced away from the field as Peter's Lysander went up in flames. Had to ride in one of the wheelbarrows as I now had neither trousers nor shoes. They hid me under the same sacking they'd used to hide the radio, stinking of onion and cows. Then handed me up a series of makeshift ladders into a loft above another loft in the barn where I am now. It's a hidden space just below the peak of the roof. Can just manage to sit up if I wedge myself right below the peak. I've not started feeling claustrophobic yet. I suppose I do spend most of my life strapped into tiny cramped spaces. There is plenty of room to stretch out if I lie down. Pretend it's the back of a fox moth. It's just as cold. Most awkward for washing and things. All water and soiled pans have to be handed up and down the ladders. Can't think what else there is to tell about the crash. I've been clothed and fed and sheltered very generously, considering they'll all be shot if I'm discovered. I'm a huge risk, a danger to myself and everyone around me. Probably the only shot-down Allied airwoman outside Russia. I've seen the leaflets. 10,000 francs reward for captured Allied flight crew or parachutists. More under certain circumstances. Certain circumstances are bound to include a lass who can give the Luftwaffe a position fix on the RAF Moon Squadron. And this terrifies me, and if I never tell anyone my real name, perhaps no one will notice. But in addition to all that, I am Jewish. It's true that I went to a Church of England grammar school, and our diet is not in the least bit kosher, even in the holidays, and Grandad is the only one of us who ever goes to the synagogue. But I am still a Brodat. I don't think Hitler will let me off for being godless. Best not think about it. I didn't think about anything for the first day and a half. Slept more than 24 hours flat out, which is just as well, because that was the day when the farm was simply crawling with German soldiers. The crash site was cordoned off for 2 days as they took photographs from every possible angle, including the air, and sifted through the wreckage. It's still cordoned off. Apparently, they have a hard time keeping out the usual vultures, small boys hunting for RAF souvenirs, a much more dangerous hobby in France than at home. I'm still unbelievably sore. Not from the crash, but from holding the dratted plane in level flight all during that final hour. Every muscle on fire, all the way up my arms, right from my fingertips to shoulders and even across my back. Feel like I've been wrestling tigers. Don't mind being able to rest, really. I never quite feel fully rested, even on my days off. I could sleep for a week. Starting to nod again now. Light comes in through slats netted over with chicken wire to keep out pigeons. The platform of this loft space is halfway up the slats. If you were suspicious and counted them, you would see more slats on the outside than on the inside. It's a clever hiding place, but not foolproof. Before I fall asleep again, I'm going to construct some place to hide these stupid notes. If anyone reads this, court-martial will be the least of my worries. I wish Julie would turn up. Spent all this afternoon, Thursday 14th of October, on the threshing floor of this barn, learning to fire a Colt 32 revolver. What fun! Mitraillette and a few of her chums kept guard. Paul provided lessons and gun. The gun is part of his SOE kit, but he has got a bigger one, a Colt 38, from an arms drop, and they all think I need one as I have nothing else to hide behind, no papers and very little French. As far as Paul's concerned, I'm just another SOE agent to be trained up quickly. Not sure how this happened, but at any rate, I am learning to be proficient in the SOE's double tap system. You fire twice, rapidly, each time you aim so you never have to take any prisoners. I'm a decent shot. I think I would even find it quite a satisfying challenge if it weren't for the noise. And Paul's wandering hands. Oh, I remember him now, from that ferry flight in England. His hand on my thigh in the air. Ugh! Mitraillette says it's not just me. He does it to every woman under 40 who comes near enough for him to touch. Don't know how Julie puts up with such stuff. Encourages it even as part of her work. Enjoys it more than I do, perhaps? No. I think she's just bolder than me. In that, as in everything. Mitraillette, it turns out, is not the resistance girl's real name. She laughed at my stupidity for thinking it was. It's her code name. She's told me both, as it's awkward, her father shouting her real name just below my louvered window when she's supposed to come and feed the hens. It's a poultry farm. I won't write down her real name. Mitraillette means submachine gun. It suits her. Maman, her mother, is from Alsace, and the children all speak German fluently. There is a younger sister they call La Cadette. I think it means the little sister. The brother, the eldest, is a Gestapo officer, an actual Frenchman who's been made an underling in the Orme Gestapo headquarters. The family, including Maman, despise the boy's Nazi collaboration, but they fuss and cluck over him when he visits home. Apparently collaborators are so violently detested in Orme that anyone will shoot them, even ordinary citizens who have no connection to the resistance, and he has to keep his head down. Etienne, I think he's called, his real name. He doesn't know it, but he's quite safe. He is brilliant cover for his own family's resistance entanglement, and there are orders out to keep him alive. Mitraillette spent a good 2 hours chatting with me last night, up here in the loft in the dark. Her English is as rubbish as my French, but though we persist in thoroughly mangling both languages, we understand each other pretty well. We were watching the road while they shifted some of the explosive. She has a wooden bird whistle for warning the people below if she sees headlamps coming down the hill. Since I arrived, the explosive has not been very safely hidden under bales of hay on the floor of the barn. This building is easily 300 years old, probably more. Timber-framed wattle and daub plaster like Withenshaw Hall. And if anyone should drop a match or cigarette, the whole place would go up like Vesuvius. There's no way I'd ever be able to get out. I try not to think about it. I also try not to fret over Julie. Word is that the day before yesterday she met her first contact. I don't know where or who, my information is all third hand, but what a huge relief to know she landed safely. My understanding is that the reception committee who prepared the landing field is not connected to Julie's prearranged contacts in Orme. More accurately, they are all different members of the same circuit. It's meant to work like a relay race with Julie as the baton, but she's missed out the first leg of the race, the connection at this end, probably due to coming down in the wrong place in the dark. Must get in the habit of calling her Verity. Everyone else does. Her circuit is called Damask, after their most venerable member, who is 83 years old and a rose grower. They generally label circuits by some trade. I haven't been told the rose grower's name. No one goes by or even knows real names. I wouldn't want to give Julie's name away by accident. Her assignment is so dead secret that her first contact wasn't told she and her goods had arrived until she'd told him herself. So although he was aware there had been a Lysander crash outside Orme, he hadn't known she'd survived until he met her. And when she spoke to him, neither one of them knew that the explosives landed safely as well. But word is spreading through the circuit that both Verity and the explosives are here. Next stop, the town hall. She's supposed to get access to the city archives and look up the original architect's drawings for the old hotel building that the Orme Gestapo use as their headquarters. She won't be able to do that till we sort out her ID, though. We are puzzling over how to do it. Mitraillette is not allowed to speak directly to Julie's Verity's contact, so she has to find someone else to take the message. They keep their tasks and names very carefully separated, and we don't want to hand over Verity's Katerina Harbicht papers to anyone but Verity, i.e. Katerina herself. Mitraillette is going to try to arrange for V to pick them up from one of the resistance cachettes, their secret letterboxes. That means we have to pass word along somehow. I say we, as though I were going to do something dramatic to help, other than sit here blowing on my fingers to keep them warm and hoping no one finds me. The operation is to go ahead as planned. They've got the equipment, they've got Verity, the contacts are all in place. With a little care and planning, it'll be the Orme Gestapo headquarters that goes up like Vesuvius and not this barn. If only Ketta Harbicht weren't operating behind enemy lines, as it were, with Kitty Hawk's British identity papers. I'm beginning to think it was one of her less clever ideas to call herself Kitty Hawk in German. Terribly sweet, but not very practical. Though to be fair, she wasn't expecting me to come along. I've taken Paul's revolver apart and put it back together 7 times. It's not as interesting as a radial engine. Another Lysander has come down. Unbelievable, but true. This one made it past the anti-aircraft guns and came in just as planned, easy peasy, about 70 miles north of here on Monday the 18th of October. Unfortunately, the landing field had become a sea of mud because there had been nothing but rain, rain, rain for the past week, all over France, I think. The reception committee at the field up there spent 5 hours trying to haul the plane out of the mud. They hitched a pair of bulls to it as it was too muddy even to drive a tractor onto the field, but finally had to give up as it was about to get light. So they've destroyed another aircraft and there is another special duties pilot stuck here. I say another, but of course I'm not really special duties. There's some small comfort in not being the only one. Mean and piggish of me, I know, but I can't help it. There'd been talk of trying to get me out of here on that plane. They were going to try to squeeze me in with the two people I was supposed to have airlifted back to England in the first place. I'd have had to sit on the floor, but SOE and ATA are rather frantic about me at home and want me out of here. It hasn't happened. Any number of things need to be arranged, then rearranged, then go wrong at the last minute. Every message to London has to be laboriously encoded and delivered on a bicycle to a hidden wireless set 10 miles from here. The message perhaps doesn't get sent straight away because someone has disturbed the leaf in the keyhole or the eyelash folded in the note left for the courier, and then they have to wait 3 days to make sure they are not being watched. The rain has been dreadful, with cloud at 1,000 feet and visibility next to nothing in the river valleys where the mist hangs. No one could land here anyway. No field closer than Tours, 50 miles away, to replace the one I ruined. They call a ruined field brûlé. Burnt, which mine is. They will have to send a Hudson to collect us all, as there just isn't room in a Lysander, and that will mean waiting for the mud to dry out. Ugh. I have never been so damp and miserable for such a long time. It's like living in a tent. No light, no heat. They pile the goose feather quilts and sheepskin in with me, but the rain is constant. Grey, heavy, autumnal rain that stops you doing anything. Even if you weren't trapped in a crawl space under the eaves. I have been down a few times. They try to give me a meal in the farmhouse each day to warm me up and break the monotony. I haven't written anything here for a week as my fingers are starting to get chilblained. So dead cold always. I need those mittens I made out of the pattern book Gran gave me, with the flaps that flick back so you can use your fingers. Essentials for the Forces, that book was called. If I'd known how essential those mittens would be now, I'd never have taken them out of my flight bag except to wear them. Not like the flipping gas mask. I wish I was a writer. I wish I had the words to describe the rich mixture of fear and boredom that I have lived with for the past 10 days, which putters on indefinitely ahead of me. It must be a little like being in prison, waiting to be sentenced, not waiting for execution, as I'm not without hope. But the possibility that it will end in death is there. And real. In the meantime, my days are duller than a lifetime as a mill girl endlessly loading shuttles. Nothing to do but suck on my cold fingers like Jamie in the North Sea and worry. I'm not used to it. I'm always doing, always at work on something. I don't know how to occupy my mind without my whole self being busy. The other girls at Maidsend all lay snoring or knitting or doing their nails when the rain was tipping it down in such grotty visibility no one could fly. Knitting was never enough. Got so bored with it. Can't concentrate on anything bigger than socks or gloves. I always ended up scrounging bicycles to go exploring. Remember the bicycle adventure when I told Julie all my fears? They seem so trivial now. The quick, sudden terror of exploding bombs is not the same as the never-ending, bone-sapping fear of discovery and capture. It never goes away. There isn't ever any relief, never the possibility of an all-clear siren. You always feel a little bit sick inside, knowing the worst might happen at any moment. I said I was afraid of cold. It's true, cold is uncomfortable, but not really something to be afraid of, is it? What are the 10 things I'm afraid of now? Number 1. Fire. Not cold or dark. There is still a great pile of explosive 808 hidden under the hay bales on the floor of this barn. The smell is overwhelming sometimes. It's like marzipan. Just can't forget it's there. If a German sentry poked his nose in here, I don't know how he'd not notice it. It makes me dream I'm eternally rolling icing for fruitcakes, believe it or not. Number two, bombs dropping on my gran and grandad. That hasn't changed. Number three, bombs dropping on Jamie. In fact, I worry about Jamie a good deal more now I've experienced a little of what he's up against. Number four, new to this list, the Nazi concentration camps. Don't know any of their names, don't know where they are. Suppose I haven't been paying attention. They were never very real. Grandad roaring about ominous stories in The Guardian didn't make them real. But knowing I may very likely end up in one is more frightening than any news story could ever be. If they catch me, and they do not shoot me straight away, they will slap a yellow star on me and ship me out to one of those dreadful places. No one will ever know what happened to me. Number five, court-martial. I'm trying to remember what else I told Julie I was afraid of. Most of those fears we talked about that first day in the canteen were just so stupid. Getting old. It embarrasses me to think about it. The things I told her on our bicycle adventure were better. Dogs. Ha! That reminds me. Number six, Paul. I had to chase him out of here at gunpoint. It was, of course, his own gun, the one he gave me and taught me to use. Perhaps I was overly dramatic to pull the gun on him, but he had actually come up into my loft on his own in broad daylight without any of the family knowing he was here, which is dead alarming of itself. They are so careful about keeping track of who comes and goes, and they need to trust him. I suppose all he wanted was a kiss and a cuddle. He backed off looking deeply injured and left me feeling guilty and dirty and prudish all at once. It frightened me terribly, more afterwards when I thought about it than at the time. If he or anyone tried to force himself on me, I couldn't run away. I couldn't call for help. I'd have to endure it without a fight and in silence, or risk giving myself up to the Nazis. I lay awake in a funk nearly all night with Paul's dratted gun in my hand, my ear pressed to the trapdoor listening, expecting him to come back and try again under cover of darkness, as if he hasn't got better things to do under cover of darkness. Finally, I fell asleep and dreamed there was a German soldier battering at the trapdoor. As he broke through, I shot him in the face, woke up, gasping in horror, then fell asleep and had the same dream again and again, at least three times in a row. Every single time, I thought, that was a dream earlier, but this time it's real. When Mitraillette turned up to bring me my breakfast ration of bread and onions and their dreadful pretend coffee, I blurted out the whole sordid story. In English, of course. I finished by bursting into tears. She was sympathetic, but confused, not sure how much she understood, and don't think there's anything she can do about it anyway. In English, of course, leads me to fear number seven, being English. I think I told Julie I was afraid of getting my uniform wrong and people laughing at my accent. And I suppose, in a sense, I'm still worried about these things. With better reason. My clothes! Mitraillette's don't fit me in the waist and hips. Have to wear a frock belonging to her mum. Outmoded and severe. A thing no self-respecting girl of my generation will be caught dead in. Mitraillette's pullover does fit, and I have a many times patched over wool jacket that once belonged to her brother. The combination of these warm outer garments and the dowdy frock looks dead weird. The outfit is completed with wooden clogs, just like Gran's gardener wears at home. There's no hope of better equipping me unless we use Julie's clothing coupons. I don't mind not being stylish, but I'm obviously wearing an odd collection of cast-offs, and if I'm seen, people will wonder. And my accent? Well, Mitraillette says she can tell by the way I walk that I am not from Orme. If I walked to the corner shop dressed in the height of fashion and didn't breathe a word to anyone, I would still betray myself and everyone around me. Oh, I am so afraid of letting them down. Is this next lot fear or guilt? It feels like a lump of granite stuck in the gears of my brain and stripping them raw. Letting people down. A great circular list of failure and worry. What if I'm caught and give away the location of the RAF Moon Squadron? I've already let down every one of those Lysander pilots, who liked and encouraged me so much they were daft enough to let me take one of their planes to France. Special Operations Executive trusted me too, not to mention the refugees I was supposed to pick up here. Oh, I'm a colossal failure as far as my own ATA ferry pool is concerned. Done a bunk and AWOL indefinitely. And I dread betraying my hosts by accident. By being found on their property, or by being caught and giving them away under pressure. Don't really believe I could keep anything from the Gestapo if they got to work on me. Oh, help, here I am again, back to the location of the Moon Squadron and the Gestapo. Everything leads to the Orme Gestapo. Well, they can be fear number nine. The Nazi secret police, something else it makes me sick to think about. I'm fairly certain the Orme Gestapo headquarters will be my first stop on my way to whatever prison I end up in. Unless the Orme Gestapo headquarters is blown to bits first, but that doesn't seem likely to happen any time soon. It's 10 days since we got here. Part of the reason I've not written since last week is because I don't want to put to paper what I'm about to write. Don't want to give any kind of reality to this ugly, perhaps. Also, if I'd let myself write this week, I'd have just wasted half my paper listing possibilities and wondering. It's been too long. It's torment, pure torment, waiting for news, for anything. Julie has vanished. It's true she made her first meeting, Tuesday 12th of October, the day after we got here, but then she simply disappeared as if she'd never been in France. Today's the 21st, she's been missing for over a week. I understand now why her mother plays Mrs. Darling and leaves the windows open in her children's bedrooms when they're away. As long as you can pretend they might come back, there's hope. I don't think there can be anything worse in the world than not knowing what's happened to your child. Not ever knowing. Here it happens all the time. It happens all the time. People just disappear. Entire families sometimes. No one ever hears of them again. They vanish. Shot down pilots, of course. Torpedoed sailors, of course. You'd expect that. But here in France, it happens to ordinary people too. The house next door just turns up empty one morning, or the post office clerk doesn't show up for work, or your friend or your teacher doesn't come to school. I suppose there was a time a couple of years ago when there was a chance they'd run away to Spain or Switzerland. And even now there is a narrow hope that Julie has gone to ground until some unknown danger passes. But more often than not, the missing face has been sucked into the engines of the Nazi death machine. Like an unlucky lapwing hitting the propeller of a Lancaster bomber. Nothing left but feathers blowing away in the aircraft's wake as if those warm wings and beating heart had never existed. There is no public record of the arrests. They happen every day. Often people look the other way if there is a fight in the street to avoid getting in trouble themselves. Julie has vanished. It shocks me to write it. To see it here in the margin of my ATA pilot's notes alongside de Havilland Mosquito, engine failure after takeoff. But it's true. She has vanished. She may already be dead. I'm afraid I will be caught. I'm afraid Julie is dead. But of all the things I'm afraid of, there's nothing that frightens me so much as the likelihood, the near certainty, that Julie is a prisoner of the Orme Gestapo. It made my spine crawl as I wrote it down, and it makes me shiver again to read the words I just wrote. Must stop. This ink is amazing. It really doesn't smear, even when you cry on it. Verity. Verity must remember to call her Verity. Bother. They can't move forward. No inside contacts yet. With Julie out of the picture, everything's stalled. She's supposed to be the central link in this operation, the informer, the German-speaking translator moving between the town hall and the Gestapo headquarters. Mitraillette can't do it. She's local, too suspicious. Now the whole Damask circuit is on edge, afraid that Julie's capture will betray them. I mean, that Julie will betray them herself by giving them away under pressure. The longer the silence, the more certain it is that she's been caught. Meanwhile, they're still trying to do something about me. It's been over 2 weeks. Nothing's changed. Had my photograph taken. It will be a while before the exposures are developed. Difficult setting me up with a trusted photographer. He's busy on many fronts. Most of the negotiating didn't involve me. Again, they've gone to a good deal of effort on my behalf. Could tell how nervous Mitraillette's maman was about having me and the photographer and Paul all gathered in her sitting room. The idea is to do over Verity's false carte d'identité to turn Kitty Hawk, I mean me, into Käthe, I mean Katharina Habicht. I would become the family's quiet and not too bright cousin from Alsace, whose parents have been bombed out and who has come here to be looked after and help with the farm. It's a risk for countless reasons, the worst being that there's always a possibility that if Julie has been caught, she may have already compromised the name. We've talked and talked about it. Mitraillette, Maman and Papa, me as chief consultant and Paul as translator. If the Nazis have got Julie, Verity, I mean, we've to assume, one, they've also got Margaret Brodat's pilot's license and national registration card and already know my real name, and two, Julie's told them her own real name, because as an enlisted officer under the Geneva Convention, that's what she's supposed to do, and it's her best chance of being treated decently as a prisoner of war. We don't think she'll tell them the name on the forged Katharina Habicht carte d'identité. Paul doesn't think they're likely to ask, and even if they did, she could tell them anything and they wouldn't know the difference. She could make up a name. She would, too. Or perhaps give them Ava Seiler. But the real reason she won't tell them Käthe Habicht's name is because she knows that if I landed safely, it is the only identity I have. The photographer works for the enemy, too. Proper British airmen flying over the European continent carry a couple of photographs in their emergency kit, just in case they're shot down and need fake ID. But my photographs are being taken by an official Gestapo-employed French photographer. One of his other jobs is developing enlarged pictures of my crash. He brought some of the prints to show us. Impossible to describe the dual thrill and dread in watching him undo the string fastener of his cardboard folder, then slide free the glossy paper. Paper destined for the desk of the Gestapo captain in Orme. Like feeling the buffet of the first shadow fingers of cool air touch your wings as the storm cloud you've been trying to outrun begins to catch up with you. This is how close I am to the Orme Gestapo. The photographer could hand me over with the pictures. He warned me in English. Not nice to look at. The most disturbing thing was knowing it was meant to be me. That terrible, charred corpse was wearing my clothes, bone and leather fused into the shattered cockpit in my place. ATA wings still tracing a pale outline on the sunken wreck of the breastbone. There's a blown-up detail of the ghostly wings, just the wings. You couldn't tell it was an ATA crest in particular. I didn't like it. Why focus on the pilot's badge? Just why? What is this for? I asked. I could just about manage the French. What will they do with these photographs? There is an English airman being held in Orme, the photographer explained. They want to show him these pictures, ask him questions about them. They shot down a British bomber this week. In decent weather, we get swarms of Allied aircraft flying over every night, and some in daylight, too. Think we've stopped bombing Italy since the Allied invasion last month. But now Italy's declared war on Germany, things are really hotting up. We're too far from Orme to hear the sirens unless the wind is in the right direction, but you can see the sky flashing when the gunners on the ground fire at the passing planes. That was me holding tight to the close-up print of my burnt wings, trying to figure it out. It's the least horrific of the pictures of the fake pilot, but it's the one that disturbed me the most. Finally, I looked up at Paul. What's a captured lad from a bomber crew going to know about a wrecked reconnaissance aircraft? He shrugged. You tell me. You're the pilot. The sheet of glossy paper shook in my hand. Stop that right away. Fly the plane, Maddie. You think their captured English airman might be Verity? Paul shrugged again. She's not an airman. Nor English, I added. But she's probably carrying your English pilot's license and the national registration card, Paul pointed out quietly. There aren't any photographs on your British ID, right? You're a civilian. So even if they know your name, they won't know what you look like. Tell me, Kitty Hawk, how convincing do you think these pictures are? Would you recognise yourself? Would anyone else? That melted corpse was hardly even recognisable as a human being. But those ATA wings? Oh, I don't want Julie to see these pictures and be told she's looking at me. Because she knows the plane, there's no denying it's the same plane. The markings are still visible. R3892. I just can't think about this. Julie in prison being made to look at these pictures. I said to Paul, ask the photographer how long he can store before he has to turn these in. The photographer understood me without needing a translation. I wait, he said. The Gestapo captain will wait. The pictures were not good when I made them, perhaps. Not clear enough and need to be made over again. It will take a long time. The Englishman must tell the captain of other things. He will not see the pictures of the pilot yet. We can give him these others to begin. He pulled more glossy sheets from the folder and held one out to me. It was the inside of the rear cockpit loaded with the ashy remains of 11 radio, 11 wireless sets. I gasped with laughter. Beastly of me, I know, but it is a brilliant photograph. Totally convincing. It's the best thing I've seen in the last 2 weeks. If they have got Julie and they show her that picture, it will be a gift. She'll make up an operator and a destination for every single one of those phony radios, and the frequencies and code sets to go with it. She will lead them blind. We, may we? Oh yes, I stuttered, a bit too hysterically, and everybody frowned at me. I handed both photos back, the one that will break Julie and the one that could save her. Give them these. Good, said the photographer, cool and neutral. Good. It will make less trouble for me if some of the prints are produced on time. I am so just dead humbled by the risks everybody takes, the double lives they all lead, how they shrug and go on working. Now we take your picture, Mademoiselle Kitty Hawk. Maman made a fuss over me and tried to make my hair pretty. Hopeless. The photographer took 3 shots and began to laugh. Your smile is too big, mademoiselle, he said. In France, we do not like these identity cards. Your face must be neutral, oui? Neutral, like the Swiss. Then we all laughed, a bit nervously, and I think I ended up glaring. I do try to smile at everybody. It's one of the only things I know about being undercover in enemy-occupied territory. That and how to fire a revolver using the double tap. Can't begin to say how much I hate Paul. The photographer had also bought me a pair of lined woolen climbing slacks belonging to his wife. Good ones, well made and not much used, which he gave to me after he put away his equipment. I was so surprised and grateful, started to blub again. The poor man took this the wrong way and apologized for not bringing a prettier dress. Maman descended on me, mopping my tears with her apron with one hand, showing how warm and thick the slacks are with the other. She worries about me a good deal. Paul turned to the photographer and made a remark in a matey undertone as though they were sharing a pint in a pub. But he said it in English so that I could understand it and no one else would. Kitty Hawk won't mind trousers. What she's got between her legs she doesn't use anyway. I hate him. I hate him. I know he's the organizer, the keystone of this resistance circuit. I know my life depends on him. I know I can trust him to get me out of here. But I still hate him. The photographer gave Paul an embarrassed chuckle. Man to man, jolly saucy joke. Gave me a sideways glance to see if I got it. Of course, I was blubbing away in Maman's large French farmhouse embrace and looked like I probably hadn't heard. And I pretended that I hadn't, because it was more important that I thank the photographer properly than that I'd tackle Paul.
Hate him.
After the photographer left, I had to go and have another target practice session with Paul. He still doesn't keep his hands to himself, even after being told off at gunpoint, even with Mitraillette watching. Doesn't let them stray, but just leaves them on your arm or shoulder for much too long. You must know how much I'd like to blow his brains out with his own gun. But he obviously thrives on danger. And despite my violent dreams, I don't really have it in me. I expect he knows that too. The last weekend in every month, Maman is permitted to kill a specially authorized chicken so she can produce Sunday dinner for half a dozen Gestapo officers. Because of Etienne being local, his family has to entertain his superiors pretty regularly. And of course, the Nazis know the food is better on the farm than in town. I spent the whole 3 hours of their last visit gripping my Colt 32 so tightly that 4 days later my hand is still stiff. By squinting sideways through the slats in the barn wall, I could just make out the bonnet of their gleaming Mercedes-Benz where they left it parked in the courtyard. I got a glimpse of the hem of the captain's long leather coat which caught on the mudguard as they got back in. It was Lacadette, the little sister, who told me about the visit. Lacadette is really called Amelie. Seems a bit daft not to write the family's names now, as the Nazis are so familiar with them anyway. But I've come to think of the Thibauts as simply Maman and Papa, and I can't think of Mitraillette as Gabrielle Therese any more than I can think of Julie as Katerina. The family lets Amelie do most of the talking when the Nazis occupy their kitchen. She appears to have a head full of feathers, but utterly charms the visitors with her fluent Alsatian German. Everybody likes her. They try to make this monthly visit informal, everyone wearing civilian clothes, though they all defer to the Gestapo captain as if he were the King of England. Both Mitraillette and her sister agree he's dead scary, calm and soft-spoken, never says anything without consideration. About the same age as Papa Thibault, the farmer. His subordinates all live in terror of him. Captain doesn't make favourites of anyone, but he likes talking to Amelie and brings her a small gift every time he comes. This time it was a matchbook embossed with the crest of the hotel they've taken over for their offices. CDB, Chateau de Bordeaux. Amelie has passed it on to me. Sweet of her, but I'm not keen to set fire to anything in here. They start with drinks. The men all stand about the kitchen sipping cognac, Lacadette serving, Mitraillette sitting awkwardly in a corner with the sullen German lass who gets dragged everywhere as the captain's secretary, stroke valet, stroke slave girl. She's also their driver. Doesn't take cognac with the men as her hands are full holding the captain's file folder and gloves and hat during all the small talk. Today the brother, Etienne, had a great big ugly lump on his forehead over his left eye, quite fresh. A purple bruise with a bloody dent in the centre, still swollen. Lacadette was all over him with sympathy. Maman and Mitraillette a bit more restrained. They didn't dare ask how he got it. Well, his little sister did dare, but he wouldn't tell her. He was also thoroughly embarrassed by the attention, the fuss being made in front of his boss and two colleagues and the other girl too. So, Lacadette turns to the captain and asks, "Does Etienne spend the whole working day scrapping with people? He might as well be back in school." "Your brother's very well behaved," the captain answers, "but sometimes a vicious prisoner reminds us how dangerous a policeman's work can be." "Is your work dangerous too?" "No," he tells her blandly. "I have a desk job. All I do is talk to people." "Vicious prisoners," she points out. "That's why I have your brother to guard me." At this point, the slave girl's secretary sniggers very, very quietly behind her hand, pretending to clear her throat and making a sketchy wave at Etienne's bruised head. And she murmurs to Mitraillette beside her, "A woman did that." "Did he deserve it?" Mitraillette whispers back. The secretary shrugs. It is hell, not knowing what has happened or what is happening. To Julie. More than 3 weeks now, already into November. Complete silence. She might as well be on the dark side of the moon. Incredible what slender threads you begin to hang your hopes on. They don't interrogate many women in Orme. Usually send them straight to prison in Paris, I think. I'm sure my heart actually stopped for a second when I heard it. And again, writing it down. A woman did that.